Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. Get the book that Kevin Gutzman called the single best volume on original intent ever written, My Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. It is the book. When people ask me what's my favorite, that's the one. Pick it up wherever books are sold online and get a real education on the Constitution. Just as I predicted on this show, the Supreme Court keeps Donald Trump on the ballot in Colorado, and establishment historians took a beating. I'll talk about that on this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to the Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back on the program. Very glad to be here. Well, we had the big decision come out of the Supreme Court yesterday. It's why this show was coming out a little bit later today so I could record it. Had time to record it in the morning the next morning. But this is huge. And of course, as I predicted on this show, it would be a very interesting decision. I originally predicted a couple of months ago that it would be a 5-4 decision in favor of Trump. Well, guess what? It was essentially a 5-4 decision in favor of Trump. Now, all nine justices argued that Colorado could not keep Trump off the ballot, but four of them had reservations about that. There was a concurring opinion, which was almost a dissent. As I said, it was going to be 5-4. Then later, after listening to the arguments, I thought, well, it's going to be 9-0 or 8-1, but it turned out to be 9-0 in favor of Trump staying on the ballot. But the arguments against it, right? I mean, kind of this expansion of the 14th Amendment. Certainly the three liberal justices believe that. Amy Coney Barrett, who I thought would be in the 5-4, I thought maybe Roberts would go to the 4, but it was Barrett. She is certainly still saying that maybe the states can do something with the 14th Amendment in Section 3 of that. But regardless, I was right on both accounts. That's why you listen to the show and why I said on social media I should be making Rush Limbaugh kind of money to do this. But unfortunately, the big media syndication outlets are not calling on me. That's okay. I've got you. Now, let me go into some of the things about this. And in fact, I'm not really going to read the decision very much. I'll say just some general things about the decision. First and foremost, I think that Barrett, in some ways, is actually right, that states can enforce provisions of the Constitution. I mean, state judges take an oath to defend the Constitution. So do state officers. They do it. This is what I've mentioned with Texas. Texas can enforce the Constitution. They can round up people crossing the border illegally and send them back to Mexico or wherever else they're from. They can do that. State officers take an oath to support the Constitution. Now, what states don't have to do is enforce unconstitutional laws. I've talked about that on this show. That's non-commandeering. But if the law is constitutional, they take an oath to do it, and they have to enforce those things. Now, the situation with the ballot is very interesting because it wasn't until the late 19th century that we had states involved in that process. And some of that was because of the 14th Amendment, but also because states wanted to regulate who could and could not be on a ballot. Now, in some ways, that's a little bit of an expansion of power that maybe they don't have. You know, private entities, parties can put anybody they want on the ballot. The states can sort that out after they get nominees, but you could have any party nominate anyone. And if that person had been convicted of, say, insurrection well, then the state could potentially keep them off the ballot. What if that person was a criminal in any other way? What if they were in jail? I mean, well, that person could be kept off the ballot. So, I mean, there are some things, or if they're not old enough, they're, you know, whatever the situation is, the state could review that and say, well, no, this person can't be there. Also, Congress has a role in that regard as well. They can refuse to seat people in Congress, but the states certainly get to decide who chooses electors, and so in that way, there could be some control of that for the states. But we've expanded that power beyond, I think, what the Constitution mandates, and the states determining who can and cannot be on the ballot in a primary. I mean, that's what we're talking about. I'm recording this on Super Tuesday, of course, and primary, I mean, look, as long as a party wants to have a convention and nominate someone through a primary, there shouldn't be any state control of that whatsoever. Now, the parties could say we're a closed primary where we don't have anybody but registered Republicans. I mean, it's a club, basically. A primary is a party's a club. You can join the party. And in fact, really, I mean, honestly, the primary should be closed. You should have to be a member of that party to vote in the primaries. If you don't want to join either party, then you don't get to choose. And of course, you could go and choose somebody else. I mean, this is the whole point. So the parties are something separate from the situation of a general election. Now, if Trump is nominated out of these primaries, and he will be for the Republicans, so there's no way that Trump is going to lose the nomination. If he comes out the nominee, and somehow in the next few months, the Trump is convicted of insurrection, which is not going to happen because there was no insurrection, then perhaps you could argue that Trump should not be on the ballot, right? I mean, if he is someone who has been convicted of insurrection, then maybe you shouldn't be there. Now, you can say, well, McClanahan, he has been convicted. The Colorado court said he was an insurrectionist. There was an insurrection. But they really, I mean, they kind of said that, but really didn't. And here's the problem with all of that, of course. Trump left office. If there was an insurrection, if there was a coup, which is essentially what they're saying, he's trying to overthrow the government of the United States, then he wouldn't have left office. There's no insurrection here. When Democrats firebomb courthouses and riot and break windows and bust down doors, that's just a mostly peaceful but fiery protest. When Republicans do it, it's an insurrection. When Democrats challenge the results of an election, I mean, and they did this in 2016. When they challenge the results of election and call it illegitimate, that's just democracy. When Republicans do it, it's an insurrection. You see, there's a major difference. This is why this is all politically charged and motivated. In fact, just because you say it's an insurrection doesn't make it so, and that's the problem. I could even argue that even in 1861 to 65, we didn't have an insurrection. We had the South leaving the Union and saying they had their own government. That's not an insurrection at all. That's independence. Were the colonists engaging in insurrection in 1776 and 75 when they said, you know, we've got our own constitutions, we're doing this, you're no longer our legitimate government? Is that an insurrection? You're not overthrowing the government. You're saying we just are independent. We just no longer believe in that government. You have your government. The United States government continued to exist during the war. So you can actually make a case there wasn't even an insurrection then. It was an independence movement. Lincoln was very careful to call it a rebellion. You could say, well, rebellion, insurrection, same thing. Not really. If you're going to create your own government, that's something entirely different. If you're trying to overthrow Abraham Lincoln, which they weren't trying to put Jefferson Davis as president of the United States, that would be an insurrection or even a rebellion. You could say that too. But they weren't trying to do that. And I'll give you another example. In the United States, in Rhode Island, during the John Totter administration, you had something called the Dorr Rebellion. It was a real rebellion because they instituted their own government. The Dorrites had their own government. This is something I answered on the Q&A, but just briefly here. They had their own government, and then you had the parallel government, the established government of Rhode Island, and the people were saying, well, they're trying to control the government. They were trying to actually have a new government of Rhode Island. The Confederate states weren't trying to have a new government of the United States. They had their own government in their own central authority in their own states, and the U.S. government was no longer in force there because they weren't part of the United States. The Dorrites weren't saying we're a whole other state. They're saying we're part of Rhode Island. This is the official government, you see. That's not what the Confederacy was doing. Now, again, in Trump's case, there was no insurrection. There was no insurrection. You had a riot. That's something that did happen. You had a riot. And people shouldn't do that. People shouldn't have busted down doors and broken windows and all those kind of things. None of that should have happened. But on the other hand, who is going to overthrow the government? Were these people walking into the Capitol going to overthrow the government? No, they couldn't. No one would have thought that they had control. Everyone would have said, this is ridiculous. There's no control here. These people are just rioting. That's a whole other situation. And Trump, again, left office. He left office. He didn't stick around as president and say, I'm the legitimate president. Joe Biden is illegitimate. He left. Now, bad decorum. He wasn't there for the inauguration. And he questioned the legitimacy of the election. That is something you can do in a democratic society. Is there legitimate? Let's use the courts to hash this out. Let's go look at this. The Democrats are all for that any time that they think they legitimately won. I mean, Stacey Abrams ran around for years in Georgia saying she was a legitimate governor of Georgia when she wasn't. Is she an insurrectionist? Is she fomenting insurrection against the government of Georgia by saying she's a legitimate governor? Well, of course not. Of course, her political career is over. But this is what she did for years, saying she was a legitimate governor of Georgia. There's no legitimacy there. That Brian Kemp was not the governor. Is that insurrection? No, it's not. But this is what the left is running around doing. Just because you say it doesn't make it true. And that's the whole problem with all of this. This is what Kavanaugh asked in the oral arguments. You know, hey, where has Trump been convicted of anything? I don't see any insurrection. Now, the left's response is, you don't need a conviction. The 14th Amendment is self-executing. In fact, they claim that everything in the Constitution is self-executing. Everything in the Constitution. And I'm going to read an article, not the decision itself, but from Manisha Sinha, who is one of the worst establishment historians. The non-U.S. citizen, as she says, who wants to lecture people in the United States on the United States history. I mean, this is very funny. But this is it. I mean, you have a situation where she's saying everything in the Constitution is self-enforcing. Well, if that's true, why do you have Congress? And why at the end say, for example, of the 15th Amendment, does it say that Congress has to pass appropriate legislation to put that into effect? Because they do. Amendments are not self-enforcing. Article 1, Section 8 is not self-enforcing. These are the things that Congress can do. These are the powers that Congress has. On the other hand, you could make an argument that the 10th Amendment is self-enforcing because it says if the Congress doesn't have the power, the states can do all of this. So in some ways, I agree with her. But let me get into this piece that she wrote for CNN. Of course, she's going to write something, hammer something out at CNN very quickly. She probably had this ready to go, knowing that the court wasn't going to side with them. Now, I really do think these people thought they would make an impact. And you can see it. I mean, they are extremely disappointed in this. So here she says, as our country confronts another crisis of American republicanism, it is another crisis of American republicanism. How? Because the Supreme Court, right, is involved in this. Well, these are the same people that want the Supreme Court, as she says in this piece, to do all kinds of things, to be anti-Republican. If you say republicanism is democracy, then the Supreme Court is the most anti-democratic thing we can do. It's why I have a whole class at McClanahan Academy. By the way, if you listen to this podcast the week of March 4th, remember to get American Populism for $99, $100 off using the coupon code POPULISM. And I've got a flash sale that runs through the 6th. Use the coupon code TRUMP and get 35% off my How the Supreme Court Screwed Up America class at McClanahan Academy. Just you put that coupon code in TRUMP, you get 35% off. It's funny. And of course, do that. Get the populism class. Also, I've got Reading Andrew Jackson on sale for $129. If you're on the email list, you've got these deals. But these deals only last for just a couple of more days as you're going to get this podcast. I mean, these are flash sales. You only get them for a short time. So make sure you pick those up. So she says, American Republicanism is in crisis. This is unleashed by former President Donald Trump and his followers' reluctance to accept the results of the 2020 presidential election. I mean, we're in a crisis because people refuse to accept election results. Now, would she say the same thing about Georgia? No. Would she say the same thing about 2016 when Hillary Clinton said, I refuse to believe that Donald Trump won the election? No. It's only when people that she doesn't like do this, right? It's Kevin Gutzman said, these people are always available to take the Democrats' talking points and run with them. But she says there's a silver lining. We are rediscovering the importance of the Reconstruction era 14th Amendment to the Constitution. We're rediscovering I don't think these people ever left the 14th Amendment. In fact, they think that is the Constitution. As I said on this show many, many times, it's why we're going to do a wonderful webinar on that at the Abbeville Institute on March 15th on Raoul Berger and the 14th Amendment. We've got three legal scholars, real legal scholars, not Manisha Sinha, but people who specialize in this, have law degrees, and are on the right side of things, are going to talk about, and PhDs as well, and they're going to talk about the 14th Amendment and Raoul Berger. That's going to be a much must-watch thing. And if you're on the Abbeville Institute email list, you're going to find out about it. She says, though ratified in 1868, the 14th Amendment laid the foundation of our modern rights in the 20th century. Well, basically, she says, though ratified in 1868, it is the Constitution. But of course, we know that the Supreme Court, with Republicans on the bench, who had been appointed at the time the amendment was discussed, ratified, did not think it did anything that she just said there. In fact, we know that the Congress didn't even think that because, well, school segregation was still legal in Washington, D.C., and the Congress had complete control over that issue. So we know this is not the original intent of the 14th Amendment. But it doesn't matter. Because this is what the Supreme Court said it is. Unless the Supreme Court says something she doesn't like, and then the Supreme Court's not supreme. You see? And she says, it contains provisions to prevent an attempt to overthrow American democracy or compromise democratic governance. Who's doing that? Who's overthrowing American democracy? I'm not certain. I mean, could you say that Colorado was trying to do that by thwarting the ability for people to vote in a primary for the candidate they want? Now, again, if Trump has been convicted of insurrection in a court of law, and the Congress has, because of Section 5, as I've talked about in this program, said that Trump can't be president of the United States, well, who's thwarting democracy but the Colorado Supreme Court? In fact, the lower court in Colorado said that they can't block Trump from being on the ballot. They think that maybe there was an issue, maybe he was an insurrection, but they can't block him. They can't do it. The framers of the 14th Amendment meant for it to be binding. If they didn't, they would not have made it a part of the fundamental law of the country. A constitutional mandate is, most importantly, self-enforcing. It does not require a law or a trial to enforce it. Well, that's a really interesting statement. So a constitutional mandate, like the 10th Amendment, is self-enforcing. It doesn't require a law. Meaning that if it says these are the powers that the general government has and it doesn't have any others, that's self-enforcing. And if the states, if it doesn't say the states can't do it, the states can do it. Kind of like secession. I agree, Sinha. I agree. No, that's not what I mean. I don't mean that at all. No. You see, these people don't even know what they're saying half the time. Their arguments are all over the place. In fact, this piece is all over the place. She says, you know, and we'll get to the contradictions. So there's a contradiction, right? The amendment is self-enforcing, but we gotta have these things to enforce it. The Supreme Court made a mistake, but we gotta rely on the Supreme Court to do these things. Supreme Court's bad, but we gotta have the Supreme Court. The 14th Amendment lays the modern rights, but we gotta have the judges to do it. We're facing a crisis of democracy, but we got to rely on an undemocratic Supreme Court to have democracy. This is how stupid this really is. On Monday, the Supreme Court decided unanimously that Trump is not disqualified from the presidential ballot. Well, yeah, only in the primary, right? I mean, I think that, again, there has to be, if you look at the five judges who said yes, Congress could say who can and cannot be on the ballot. So I think she's correct about this. But if Trump was convicted of insurrection and found guilty of that, then I'm not so certain the court would side with that particular stance. The Supreme Court was united on the idea that Trump will remain on the ballot in Colorado and that the state cannot remove him off its ballot. Again, this is the primaries we're talking about here. One other historian did comment and say, well, wait a second here. I mean, there still is some wiggle room here. This is, even though I don't like Brooke Simpson, I think he's correct about that. There is still some wiggle room in that if there's something happens later on, then things can change. But this is where the three liberal justices said, well, I mean, you've said the Congress has to get involved in doing these things. Well, I mean, they're saying that this is an obiter dicta, that the Supreme Court went outside the bounds of the decision, but they didn't, because this is what was at stake here. How do you use this thing? But the justices were divided about how broadly the decision should be construed. A conservative 5-4 majority, usually very respectful of states' rights, said that no state could remove a federal candidate off any ballot, with four justices, including the court's three liberal justices, asserting that the court should have limited its opinion. Now, if you go back to the original ratification debates and you look at what they said about elections, and I've said this on the show, one of the things they were worried about was that states would not hold elections. So that the states would say, we're not going to have a federal election, we're not going to do this, so they could block the federal government from existence. And so this is why you had where the federal government could actually get involved in the process. Ballots, though, were not a thing. Why weren't they a thing? Well, because people just voted for whoever they wanted, as long as they were old enough. And then Congress could refuse to seat people based on if they were qualified. Congress, this is why Congress can do it. Somebody shows up to Congress and they say, well, that person's not qualified. They can't sit here. You got to go back and do another election. You got to have somebody else. The Congress could determine who could sit in their body. The states determined the electors, who could be an elector, right? And it was based on state law, who could and could not be an elector. And the states had complete control over that process. In this case, now we've gotten to this point where we have party ballots and all primaries and all this kind of stuff. Again, it's confusing because of the parties. The parties have made all of this impossible to wrestle with in terms of the way it was supposed to be done. And that is an issue with political parties. Although the 14th Amendment was ratified during Reconstruction, the period immediately after the Civil War, its provisions weren't just for that historical moment in time, but a safeguard for the future. In ruling that Trump should stay on the presidential ballot of 2024, the Supreme Court has delivered a mortal blow to Section 3 that basically eviscerates its power altogether. No, it doesn't. Congress can go in and do this stuff anytime it wants. In doing so, the court is living up to its sorry 19th century history of emasculating Reconstruction federal civil rights laws and constitutional amendments. It's sorry 19th century history. Who was, when you say the sorry 19th century history, who was controlling the court at that point? The Republicans, who had been part of, well, this process of the Civil War amendments. The Reconstruction amendments. That's who was doing these things. Because they said that this is where these amendments were intended to stop. But notice the political language, right? It's an opinion piece. This is not objective. It's subjective. This is Manisha Sinha letting you know who she is politically. But they hide behind the veil of objectivity. Well, we know, looking at the record, this is the clear record. This is the clear record from looking at this stuff. It is. I mean, I'm not so certain about that. There's a whole book, Raoul Berger, which eviscerated this position, looking at the record. The Colorado Supreme Court and Trump v. Anderson had upheld Trump's disqualification per Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but the High Court boldly rejected that. Quote, because the Constitution makes Congress, rather than the states, responsible for enforcing Section 3 against federal officeholders and candidates, we reverse. Well, that's Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. But Section 3 does not call for Congress to enforce disqualification for participating or aiding in an insurrection. It only gives Congress the power to remove that disqualification by a two-thirds majority of each house. But that's not what Section 5 says. And again, this is the interesting part about all of this. What does Section 5 actually say? What does Section 3 say? What does Section 5 say? Right? Section 5, the Congress shall have power by appropriate legislations, the provisions to enforce by appropriate legislation, to enforce provisions of this article, right? Congress can enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. Congress can enforce it. She's saying, though, because Section 3 says that Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each house, remove such disability. So they're saying it's self-executing. This thing is self-executing. She's doubling down on this. Look, we're right. It's self-executing. I don't care what the Supreme Court said. This is self-executing. And in some ways, what's interesting is the leftists on the bench are duplicitous in this. In one case, they say, well, we agree that Colorado can't do this, but we also say it's self-executing. Well, that's the whole argument. If you're going to take that position, then actually take that position. But why would Section 5 be there if it was self-executing? Why would it be there? The Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. Meaning the 14th Amendment. So this is the real question, right? While correctly pointing out that the 14th Amendment restricted state autonomy, the High Court erred in claiming that the Constitution empowers Congress to prescribe how these determinations should be made. To argue that states have no power under the Constitution to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency, is tantamount to claiming that the states have no power to uphold the Constitution. Now, again, I think states can enforce parts of the Constitution. I agree with her. The states can't do it. They take an oath to do it. But Congress, if you're going to argue that there is central authority and that the federal government is supreme, which is what she believes. See, this is the thing. Sinha believes that the federal government is supreme, that the states really don't have any powers to do anything unless it's the thing she wants them to do. That's the whole part of it. It bears repeating that qualifications to run for president and the constitutional disqualification of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment are self-executing. The Colorado Supreme Court did not enforce that disqualification. It simply upheld Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But again, you have to show that somebody was actually guilty of insurrection to uphold something. That's the whole problem. This is what Kavanaugh said. Again, I'll go back to Kavanaugh. Where is the conviction of insurrection? Where does that happen? If we're going to have the courts get involved here, well, then we can't claim who is and who is not an insurrectionist here, because there's been nothing. If Trump had actually been accused and convicted of being an insurrectionist, then they could hear that, potentially. And at that point, then we can talk about whether he's disqualified. But we don't have that. We're looking at Colorado saying he can't be on the ballot because he's an insurrectionist when there's been no charge, or at least no conviction of insurrection. The Colorado Supreme Court did not enforce that disqualification. It simply upheld, right? And in their concurring opinion, the three liberal justices, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Brown Jackson, argued against a chaotic state-by-state patchwork that the Colorado decision would allegedly unleash, while chiding the majority for its lack of judicial restraint in ruling not just in this case, but for all future cases on the need for congressional legislation to enforce Section 3. But again, that was really before the court. Who enforces it? They were asking this question. And they were actually if you listen to the oral arguments, it was being, they were pleading for that. You can make this decision. You can do this. You can say how this is going to work. So they did. And now they did it wrong. Now, Manisha Sinha, after January 6th, took to Twitter and other places saying that all these people that had participated should all be disqualified from ever holding office again because I believe they're an insurrection. This is the danger of these political activists masquerading as historians. These people are dangerous. And they're really not that important, as the decision shows. They got smacked down pretty hard. Supreme Court said, yeah, no, your brief is stupid. We're not going to side with that. It's wrong. And I'm not even certain the liberal judges really agreed with it that much either. I mean, I think that they had to kind of do the Democrat talking points kind of thing because we have a political Supreme Court. As they're all pointing out here, we've got a political Supreme Court. Now, how is that democracy? These people aren't elected. They're appointed. So how is that democracy? I'm going to skip down a couple of things here. The language of Section 3, she says, is clear and unmistakable. Any person who has sworn an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and then participated in or given aid and comfort to a violent insurrection against the government of the United States is barred from holding office unless pardoned by two-thirds of both houses of Congress. But did that actually happen? That actually happened. She says, in this decision, the Supreme Court made no attempt to decide whether Trump and his followers did engage in an insurrection or not. Well, of course not, because nobody's been... I mean, now, if the followers, right, if the people that had actually been arrested and thrown in jail, if they want to try to go through the federal courts and do this, that would be a whole other situation, and perhaps the court should take that up. But that wasn't on... This is what Kavanaugh said. Nobody's been convicted of anything. So what's at stake here is interpreting the 14th Amendment. What does this actually mean? How is it enforced? What are we doing? If Trump hasn't been convicted of an insurrection, well then Congress has to enforce this. Congress is going to have to say who is and who is not an insurrectionist, or the courts, or something else. But regardless, this whole idea that it's self-executing is false. And of course, what the historians are relying on is Salmon P. Chase, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who said, hey, look, Jefferson Davis, your punishment is that you can't hold federal office, see? So go into a federal court and say, I can't be tried for treason because the Congress has already said through the 14th Amendment that my only punishment is being disbarred from office. That's my punishment. And so that's it. It's self-executing. And two judges agreed. I mean, so it became law. In a circuit court, two judges agreed, one didn't. And then, of course, when Salmon P. Chase had this issue before him, when he could actually rule on the issue, he didn't. He said it wasn't self-executing. This has had to be done in a different way. So why would Salmon P. Chase do that? If you read again Cynthia Nicoletti, this is the whole funny thing about this. Cynthia Nicoletti, who is silent on this in many ways, she's being ignored, had said, she didn't sign the amicus brief. She's a legal historian. She has said, well, wait a second here. I mean, this is kind of confusing what Chase did. Why did he do it? Well, for political motivation. In other words, he didn't really believe what he told Jefferson Davis. But all these historians are running around saying, oh, this is clear. Adam Dumby at Auburn, all these dopes. This is all clear. It's all clear. We're not cherry picking. The evidence is clear. This is the case. But it's not. It never has been. Because it's all about politics. It's all about power. And that's the problem with the 14th Amendment. It's a political amendment that was never legally ratified, by the way. But that's the issue. She says, Trump's lawyers' attempts to hold the President of the United States above the rule of law and endow him with absolute immunity, given in even in cases of personal wrongdoing, make a mockery of our Republican form of government, a constitutional guarantee, and would convert a republic into a monarchy, where the king can do no wrong. The Republican Party of the mid-19th century, the party of former President Abraham Lincoln and big government, sought to safeguard the American Republic from all future insurrectionists after the slaveholders' rebellion that had participated in a crisis of the crisis of the Union and Civil War. Now, what's interesting about this? Notice what the Republican Party, the party of big government. This is the funny thing. That's true. That's true, right? So all these West Coast Drowsians that run around saying that Republican Party, we need to be the Republican Party of the 19th century. She's right. This is the party of big government. In other words, you're agreeing with all these lefties. They're all on the same side here. They just don't realize it. Abraham Lincoln is not conservative. He never was. The Republican Party was never conservative. This is why we should be very suspicious and critical of the Republican Party of the 19th century. But of course, she has to say, well, I signed one of the briefs and my book was cited in another. See, this is all about me. It's all about me. For the conservative majority in the Supreme Court to ignore this historical testimony is tantamount to betraying their own principles of constitutional interpretation. You see? And you know what else is the problem? Justice Clarence Thomas is compromised. This is really an attack on the conservative side of the court. That's all this is. And she goes on to later say, and because I'm running out of time here, where she believes the court should do things, and then she believes the court shouldn't do things. There's all these good Supreme Court decisions, and then there's these decisions. The only good Supreme Court decisions are those that expand federal power. Those are the only ones. You see, because we had all these bad decisions in the 19th century, and then we get good decisions in the 20th century, and then we get bad decisions in the 21st century. It's all about politics. It shows, I mean, what she's basically doing is exposing the problem of the Supreme Court. It's why I said the Supreme Court has screwed up America. Now, at the end of the day, again, I think that the states cannot block anybody from being on a primary ballot. That's a private situation. The parties could. If the Republican Party said we don't want Donald Trump on the ballot, they could do that. He's running for the nomination of the Republican Party. They could say we're not nominating Donald Trump. That could happen. And if Trump was ever convicted of insurrection, well, then you would have a situation where, clearly, you would have a real difficult situation. You would have an instance where the states could say, or the Congress could say, we're not going to. When they get to count the Electoral College votes, we're not going to have this. That could happen. You see? That could happen. Any of that could happen. Remember, 1868, there's no state control of ballots. So who would have done this? Not the states. Somebody would have to execute this. There's no such thing as self-executing in any way. That's like saying, you know what? The law says this, so therefore I'm guilty of it. And I'll just go put myself in jail. There's no self-executing. Something has to execute the law. There's no such thing as self-executing. Somebody or something has to execute it. And in this case, if the states aren't in control of these things, which the parties, I mean, as I've talked about on the show, the parties distributed ballots, that's how you voted. Somebody had to do it. So who would have done it? The Congress would have done it. Which is why the Congress could have said, no, this person's not an insurrectionist. No, this person's not an insurrectionist. We're going to let them sit here. The Congress could have done it. You see, that's the thing that they're missing in all of this. In the Reconstruction era, if the state sent somebody to Congress, which clearly they did, right? They sent people to Congress that had been part of the Confederacy. The Congress could say, yeah, that person's not an insurrectionist, so that person is an insurrectionist. In other words, they were getting to decide who would sit in Congress. When you got to the presidential election, right, and you had electors vote, at that point, the Congress could have said, that person is or is not an insurrectionist. They get to decide who and who is not an insurrectionist. This is how this would have worked. This whole state intermediary thing wasn't even an issue in the 19th century. This is why somebody has to execute this thing, and it would have been Congress. Now, the states, as Brief said, the states can keep somebody off a ballot if they want. But of course, they could always done this. The states get to decide who can be in state office anytime they want. The federal government really should have no control over that. And of course, because they can do that, they can decide who can be an elector. So what all of this did was say, okay, if you're an insurrectionist, you can't sit in Congress. They codify it, but the Congress can say, all right, we can have you sit here if we say you're not an insurrectionist. For electors, what they would have done is said that elector is an insurrectionist. Because remember, electors vote for president. That elector is an insurrectionist, so therefore they can't vote for president. And the Congress could say this person, as they are validating the votes of the Electoral College, this person is an insurrectionist, they can't be here. Or they're not. You see, Congress has to execute Section 3. Somebody has to do it. This is the problem. So, I'm not going to read the rest of the thing because it's just completely stupid and boring and frankly unhinged. Because that's what Manisha Sinha is. She is an activist masquerading as a historian. But at the end of the day, the Supreme Court did get this right in that Trump should not be kept off the primary ballot because the state really has no role in that. And in reality, Trump should be not kept off the ballot at all. But the Congress can decide who can be in the Congress, and of course with the electors and everything else, who can do these. There's that situation. If Trump was convicted of an insurrection, that would be a whole other story. The Congress could remove that if he was convicted of something. And look, the Republicans realized that all these things would go through the courts as well. I mean, there would be a process. People would be dragged before courts and other things. So all of that would have worked too. Okay. You wanted my position on this? I've given it to you. See you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.